Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to One Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director here at the Lowy Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here for the first event of 2017. Let me begin by recognizing one of my board members, David Lowy. Ladies and gentlemen, 2016 was a big year for the world, which means it was a big year for the Lowy Institute, and we hosted everybody from Vice President Joe Biden to Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and many others. I think all of us hoped at the end of 2016 that things might settle down in 2017. Good luck with that. Traditionally, we begin the event schedule of the year with an event looking at the year ahead. But it was apparent to us that developments in Washington were sufficiently important and of sufficient interest to our audience that we should put a special event on, the event that we're running today, to look at the inauguration of President Donald Trump and the first 10 days or so of his administration. Earlier this month, I visited Washington and New York to meet with political players, editors, think tankers, and others. And I encountered anxiety not only about Mr. Trump's personal conduct, but about the likely character of his administration and the nature of his foreign policy. I had a long analytical piece in the Financial Review yesterday that some of you may have seen. One of the points that I made was that what the Trump administration looks like over the long term relates very closely to the role that Mr. Trump himself elects to play in his administration. As one insider said to me with a smile, "Don't underestimate the influence of Donald Trump on the Trump administration." The question is, will he be, over the long term, will he be a hands-off chairman, somebody who delegates decisions, who empowers his lieutenants, who allows the normal processes of government to go on while he focuses on the particular obsessions and interests that he has? Or will he be a hands-on chief executive, managing his government very tightly, disagreeing with his lieutenants when they veer off message, and ultimately, if necessary, firing those who disagree with them? Now, my judgment when I came back from Washington was that the former would be preferable for all of us, but the latter was more likely. And I have to say, based on the 10 days or so since I got back, it's increasingly difficult to envisage President Trump as a non-executive chairman sitting above the fray. He certainly looks much more like an activist CEO. President Trump so far looks very much like candidate Trump. Many of you will remember the famous line by von Clausewitz that war is the continuation of politics by other means. It appears that Mr. Trump sees government as merely a continuation of politics by other means. What I mean is that by that is that the early indications anyway are that rather than changing himself to fit the new prerogatives of government, he is more likely to seek to change the processes and the structures in Washington. But these are, of course, early days, and our job at the Lowy Institute is to bring our expertise to bear to judge President Trump on his acts, not just on his words. And we will, over the coming months and years, we will try to maintain a sense of perspective about President Trump, not to overreact to every tweet or statement, but really to analyse what his administration means for America, for Australia, and for the world in which we all live. And to kick off that task, which will be the work of many, many days ahead, I can ask for no better panellists than today. Some of you were with us, I think, on a panel that we held on election night in November. I think we were the first think tank in the world to analyse the implications of President Trump's victory. I only say that because President Trump's victory was actually declared in the middle of the panel. So nobody literally could have beaten us to the punch. And this was the panel we had on that night. It was a fantastic discussion, like today's discussion. It was sold out and oversubscribed. And so we thought it would be a good idea to invite that same panel back and talk to them about how things look 2.5 months later. We have on the panel, on my far left, we have Professor James Curran, who is the author of this fantastic Lowy Institute paper, Fighting with America. Came out a few weeks after Mr. Trump's election. And of course, it was written and updated in light of Mr. Trump's election, where he's making an argument about the alliance based on decades of history. In the middle, we have Alex Oliver, our director of our polling program. And finally, closest to me, we have Aaron Connolly, a research fellow in our East Asia program, who also happens to be a US national. The way I'll run this is I'm going to have a conversation with my colleagues for perhaps 20, 25 minutes, and then I will go to the floor and try to give as many people as possible the opportunity to ask a question. James, let me kick off with you, and let me ask a question about the sustainability of the way that Mr. Trump is governing. One thing you cannot fault President Trump for is not delivering on his promise of change. Mm. He is delivering change, but he's also experiencing unprecedented pushback. So last Friday, as people know, Mr. Trump signed an executive order suspending the entry of all refugees to the United States, barring Syrian refugees indefinitely, and blocking entry of citizens of seven Muslim majority countries. We've all seen, I think, the footage. It sparked protests at JFK and various airports, sit-ins at Dulles, huge responses from some US allies like Germany and Canada, silence from others. In terms of public opinion, we can say that we know now the extraordinary fact that 11 days in, Mr. Trump already has a majority of Americans disapproving of the job that he's performing. And to put that in historical comparison, it took Bill Clinton 573 days before a majority expressed disapproval of his job. It took George W. Bush 1,205 days. It took Barack Obama 936 days. And I think Donald Trump achieved it in 8 days. So he's experiencing very great pushback. Now, on those numbers, in a parliamentary system, in other forms of government, you would say, this is not sustainable. This can't last. But of course, he's protected by the provisions of the Constitution. It's very hard to remove him. So I guess my opening question to you, James, is how sustainable is the pace of government under Donald Trump?
Well, I think there are a number of dimensions to it. Firstly, you'd have to deal with the individual himself, of course, where it has to start. We know that he's a man of very strong instincts. We know that he can be impulsive, that he has a tendency towards the reckless, that he's thin-skinned, which is sometimes not a great quality to have in a politician. But the question is, to what extent do these strong views that he has, to what extent will they come to be making up a coherent worldview? And then, is he actually open to change? So that would be the first point. I mean, I think that's the big question with Trump. Is he open to change? There's a lot of assumptions, and which I made myself, so I'm guilty as charged, that a lot of moderate Republicans would come into the administration and temper some of the more lurid prescriptions that Trump announced during the campaign. Now, it's too soon to say whether or not that will or won't happen. I mean, we have to, wait and see just what kind of effect that Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson will have on the kind of policies that Trump adopts, certainly in the international arena. Yes, if the first week is anything, including the inaugural address, it's what Kellyanne Conway promised, which was a shock to the system. And I guess in some ways, to be fair, like any administration, there has been a certain amount of settling in. There's been a certain amount of chaos. One has to wonder about the lack of consultation involved in the making of some of these executive orders that have been produced. That will trip up an administration if that continues, if the engines of policy, the way in which policy is ground out through the system of the American bureaucracy, if that continues to come up against problems and impediments, then I think that will trip up the administration. The third point, I think, expectations. The expectations that Trump has unleashed are of a huge magnitude. You know, a child of globalization, he at times appears to want to pull the drawbridge up. He's promising those Rust Belt states that he's able to bring back the manufacturing. Now, he's already claimed a victory in convincing the Ford factory that they weren't going to build in northeastern Mexico, that they'd come back to Michigan. The Federal Reserve is predicting sort of fairly strong and steady economic growth in the United States, though not the boom that Trump himself has predicted. So I think on any of those kind of three key areas, there's a certain vulnerability there. But as you say, it's a question of what kind of pushback comes from Congress, from the courts. We've already seen some pushback from the courts in terms of the immigration order. In foreign affairs, he does have a lot more power as Commander-in-Chief. But I still think, as infuriating as it might sound, we have to wait and see whether or not the past week becomes the norm.
Aaron, I mean, some people are speculating already that the pace of reform is unsustainable and that Mr. Trump may not serve out a full term, for example. What's the likelihood of that? What are the scenarios in which he could possibly leave office before the end of first term? And what is the likelihood, in fact, that he goes and serves out a full 4 years?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that it's incredibly difficult to remove a U.S. president. And there really does have to be a finding of criminal wrongdoing, and it has to be done by members of his own party. So the Republicans control the U.S. House of Representatives by a wide margin. And actually, when you looked at the coverage this weekend, global coverage of the immigration measures, of the immigration executive order, was resoundingly negative. But when you looked at conservative outlets in America, that coverage was actually not very negative. It was mostly pretty good. There was some quibbling with whether or not permanent residents would be able to return. And that's now a part of the policy that they've adjusted. So from the conservative perspective, from the perspective of conservative members of the House of Representatives who would have to impeach Donald Trump, he's not having a bad week. He's having a great week. And so I think we have to acknowledge that the removal of Donald Trump, short of real smoking gun evidence of criminal wrongdoing, is pretty unlikely. There's another way that you can remove a president under the Constitution through the 25th Amendment. If half the cabinet and the vice president were to declare him incapable of continuing his duties. But again, that's pretty unlikely because Donald Trump has chosen those members of the cabinet. And while perhaps you could see Marines like Mattis or Kelly and someone like Tillerson signing on to such a letter, it's very difficult to see some of the other members of the cabinet signing on to that sort of letter. And in any case, it would have to be approved by 2/3 of both houses of Congress. So it's pretty unlikely, short of real evidence of criminal wrongdoing.
So the president has real constitutional protections that obviously an Australian prime minister doesn't have. And that's one of the things I've reflected on in the last week, is that in Australia in the last couple of years, we've been very critical of the leadership churn in the position of prime minister and premier and so on. But one of the advantages, one of the virtues of the parliamentary system is that if you had a prime minister or a premier who appeared to be behaving outside the mainstream of the governing party, the competitive processes in his or her party room would probably not allow that to go on for very long. Whereas in the United States, it's a different situation. And so I think the much more realistic view is that he is likely to serve, at least a full term. Alex, can I ask you about public opinion in the United States? I quoted that Gallup figure that said that he's already hit majority disapproval. But can you give us a little bit more data about public opinion in the United States? How is it actually breaking down?
Well, as has been the case with President Trump all the way through the last year, it's a bit more complicated than just the raw figures. He does appear in polls, most of the polls taken in early to mid-January, to have a 40% overall approval rating, which makes him the lowest of all of the last presidents going back to President Carter. I think the lowest one was President Reagan at 58% around about that same time. But this is really sharply divided along partisan lines. So a few questions that the Pew organisation has asked about what's happened in the transition period and how American voters are reacting to the way that President Trump is making decisions. 84% of Democrats think that he's been too impulsive in making decisions, but only 25% of Republicans think he's been making impulsive decisions. 72% of Republicans approve of the way he's handled the transition period, and only 83% of Democrats disapprove. So you can see there the very sharp divisions and the extreme polarisation of the way Americans think about President Trump. But yes, the overall number is that he has a less than 50% approval rating, which I guess aligns pretty closely with the popular vote that he won in November. Some of the decisions that he's made about immigration are, again, those things that divide Americans, and they are decisions, so, for example, the immigration decision. migration was something that was seen as a critically important threat to American well-being. Leading up to the election, core Trump supporters, 80% of them thought that immigration was a key threat, but only 27% of Democrats thought that immigration was a key threat. So what President Trump is doing is reflecting the views and the very, very trenchant views of his own supporters. And so none of this should really be surprising when you analyse the way that those Trump supporters' attitudes have fallen.
Aaron, let me ask you about a question about an issue that James mentioned in his first remarks, and that is the question of other personnel in the administration. I mean, this is a parlor game that Washington watchers always play when a new administration is elected. You have the person of the president, but who will be around her or him? Are they hawks? Are they doves? Who will be secretaries, deputy secretaries, assistant secretaries? How will the system work? Now, a lot of people, or a good number of analysts made the argument in the transition period, or in the early transition period at least, that Mr. Trump may be normalised by establishment Republicans and more liberal Republicans signing on. How is that playing out at this point?
Well, I think we had some reason to believe that might be the case back in December when he appointed national security moderates and professionals like Jim Mattis and General Kelly and Rex Tillerson, perhaps not a national security professional, but certainly somebody who's known to be competent and bright. At this point, though, the argument that institutions matter, and to just sort of run through that argument, when I was in Washington earlier this month, a number of people said, look, this is one of the slowest transitions we've ever seen, and so there will be a lot of acting people in key roles for a while. In fact, you may have just seen earlier today the acting attorney general is ordered Justice Department attorneys to refuse to defend the executive order on immigration before the courts. I don't think they meant something quite that dramatic, but they meant at more of a lower key level, people who are responsible for Asia policy in particular, that they would remain in place. A lot of those people are career Foreign Service officers, career military officers, or Defense Department civilians, and that they would remain in place and that the institutions would sort of slow down the Trump administration, that they would capture the Trump administration in some way, and that they would moderate them over time. I don't think the folks who are making that argument recognize just how swiftly the Trump administration was going to move. And in particular, I think what we've seen over the last 10 days is an effort by the Trump White House to go around those institutions. The fact that the executive order, as James mentioned, wasn't vetted by attorneys at the Department of Justice, at the Department of Homeland Security, or even the National Security Council's lawyers, is an indication of just how they intend to go around those institutions. And even more startlingly, from my perspective, I used to work for a former National Security Advisor, Sandy Berger. And Sandy fought a particular battle in the early days of the Clinton administration to make sure that political advisors to President Clinton were not able to sit in on NSC meetings. It wasn't even a battle about whether or not they were members of the National Security Council. It was a matter of whether or not they could sit in on the meetings. And President Trump has appointed Steve Bannon as a member of the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. That effectively promotes him to cabinet rank within the confines of the National Security Council. And this is just very destructive to that process that we thought might capture President Trump and moderate his views. If you have Steve Bannon, who of course ran the alt-right website Breitbart.com, sitting next to President Trump when he's making decisions on war and peace and whether to go into a particular country, that sort of thing, that's a very disturbing development.
James, do you want to come in there? Or?
Well, to amplify what Aaron's just been saying, yes, the contest as well amongst those close to the president will be fascinating to watch, because there are clearly some very strong America firsters like Bannon, but there are some also fairly strident, virtually neoconservative warriors who believe America is involved in this existential struggle against radical Islam and who will be looking for a more forward-looking and aggressive American posture around the world. And then there are, of course, the more traditional realists, I guess, who will try and moderate some of Trump's views. So and that presumably will also be played out not only in the Middle East but also in our part of the world in terms of what it means for China. And I think that Tillerson comments in the confirmation hearing, though many attribute them as a gaffe. I mean, I'm trying to remember, what is the Washington definition of a gaffe? It's actually someone speaking the truth, isn't it? Anyway, one would not want to actually put too much store in those comments. I understand that they may have been made in a freewheeling kind of way. But these are the comments where Rex Tillerson said that China's access should be blocked to the islands in the South China Sea that they have been progressively militarising. So, you know, during the campaign, it appeared that the shape of Trump's China policy would be dominated by trade matters and by the use of trade as a fairly kind of punitive tool to punish Beijing. But now that contest amongst the advisors will be fascinating to watch, because there is clearly a more hawkish element that is looking to push back against what China is doing in that part of the world. But how does this happen? The only way you can effectively implement what Tillerson was talking about is by virtue of a naval blockade. And which allies in the region are going to sign up to that, and how would it be implemented? So I just think that struggle as well in what Aaron is talking about in terms of those who have proximity to the president, who will gain the upper hand, or will in fact Trump just continue to call the shots?
Aaron, what can you tell us about those comments? I have them here, the comments that Mr. Tillerson made in his confirmation before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said, "We're going to have to send China a clear signal that first the island building stops, and second your access to those islands is also not going to be allowed." And that's generated a lot of discussion in Australia about what that would mean and what Australia would do. So how much weight do you think we should give to those comments? And do you think that they foreshadow a more muscular approach to the South China Sea?
I wouldn't actually give very much weight to those comments, but I think we have to look at the process that led up to them. I've been told by people close to the transition that they did not allow Rex Tillerson to be briefed by State Department officials prior to his confirmation hearing. That's unprecedented. But it would have meant he went into those confirmation hearings relatively uninformed. In fact, I've talked to some of the people who were involved in briefing him, and they got very limited time with him on these particular issues. And so while Rex Tillerson actually does appear to have a good bit of familiarity with the South China Sea when he was chairman of ExxonMobil, he was actually responsible for Exxon's investment in Vietnamese blocks in the South China Sea. So it's one international issue where he has a lot of experience. But he doesn't seem to have rehearsed those lines very well. And I think the confirmation of this was Sean Spicer, the White House spokesman, coming out last week and trying to defend those remarks without actually walking them back and being very vague as to what they meant. So I would not be surprised at all to see Tillerson, should he be confirmed as Secretary of State on Wednesday morning, which looks likely, to then begin to adopt a more nuanced and responsible position on the South China Sea.
Let me ask each of you a question about how Australia should respond to the early acts of the Trump administration, and then I might go to the audience and see what people would like to ask. We're seeing a dichotomy, really, in the way that that US allies are reacting. On the one hand, you have Angela Merkel, for example, being quite critical of Donald Trump and emphasising German values according to reporting, explaining elements of the Geneva Convention and so on to him in her phone call with him the other day. Yesterday, many of you will have seen Justin Trudeau with a little tweet storm about Canada's different approach to refugees and immigration, for example. On the other hand, we saw over the weekend, we saw Ms. May, the British Prime Minister, really pulling out all stops to try to create a warm personal relationship with Mr. Trump. She spoke to the Republican convention in Philadelphia beforehand. She invited him to visit the UK and to go to Buckingham Palace and so on. Let me ask each of you, how do you think a country like Australia navigates this? On the one hand, we have real equities in the relationship with the United States. They are our most important security ally. They're our most important economic partner. And, of course, the United States will be there for a long time after Mr. Trump is gone from office. On the other hand, Mr. Trump may be behaving in ways that are outside of the mainstream and outside what is acceptable to a lot of Australians, perhaps a large majority of Australians. What would be your advice, James, to Prime Minister Turnbull? So far, he's been pretty cautious. He's said it's not my job to lecture the president about his policies. What would be your advice about how an Australian Prime Minister like Mr. Turnbull should deal with this dilemma?
Well, I think take Trump one step at a time, deal with him piecemeal, pragmatically, be very prudent, be very cautious. So far, I think the government has tried in many ways, which is understandable given what a profound shock Trump represents to the international system and to Australia's understanding of America's role in that system. So far, their reaction, I think from Turnbull and also from the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, has been to try and fit the new circumstances into an established pattern. And that, I think, is what leaders have done at all profound moments of international change. If you go back and look at the way in which Chifley and Menzies dealt with post-war decolonisation and the collapse of the maritime European empires, or the way in which prime ministers like Gorton and then Whitlam had to deal with the collapse of the rigid bipolarity of the Cold War, the emergence of a more multipolar world and a different sort of, outlook for Australia in the region. Feeling around in a kind of a swamp of uncertainty, the tendency is to go for the things that are very familiar, like the values and the history. And that is, in fact, exactly what Theresa May did, as you mentioned, in that speech in Philadelphia over the weekend. In many ways, you're dealing with an ahistorical administration, Trump. Trump doesn't have a view of American exceptionalism. He doesn't have a view of America's role in the world that is very powerful, like other presidents have had. And what May did was sort of try and use the speech to remind him of that special relationship, what it had achieved, what values underpinned it. So I think Australian leaders will have to be very careful in their language. I mean, we've seen examples in the past where Australian political leaders have disagreed quite violently with US policy. A couple of years ago, I did a study of Whitlam and Nixon and their particular lack of affection for each other. And at the time of the Christmas bombings in December of 72, a number, as many of you will know, a number of Labor ministers called the White House thugs, maniacs, criminals. Whitlam appealed to the United States and North Vietnam as if they were on the same level pegging. It enraged the White House, and in many ways this was seen to be not the way to try and engage an administration. Now, certainly it would be true to say that out of that experience did come a greater American respect for Australian self-reliance and Australian independence within the alliance. But I think it is just a question of leaders thinking very carefully and trying to find the right language that says, well, we have a strong relationship, it's been buttressed by history and these particular values, we are going to disagree from time to time. I think they could be a little bit more frank and a little bit more upfront about where those disagreements are, but you can do that without poking the president in the eye or kicking them in the shins. The language is so important, and Hawke has done it in the past. Whitlam certainly did it. Fraser did it. Howard, on occasion, did it as well. So there is a good bipartisan tradition of doing this. The final point I'd make is I think it's important to remember that these leaders, Bishop, Turnbull, and the ones before them, Abbott, Gillard, all of them came to their intellectual maturity at a time of assured American global leadership. I mean, they all came to maturity at the time either of the Cold War or in the post-Cold War period. They're not used to this idea of an America that is not globally engaged or an America on the back foot. Look at Gillard in front of the Congress. She said, I grew up with an America that can do anything. Or Tony Abbott saying in Washington a few years ago, none of us should want to find out what a shrunken America means. So there is a sense in which this political class is having to get used to a very different kind of America.
Alex, the other thing the political class has to deal with is public opinion in Australia on Mr. Trump. So how does that look at this moment, and how do you think that will play out in the way that Mr. Turnbull and the Australian government approaches the Trump administration?
We don't have a big read on how Australians feel about President Trump. We had a very strong read on the way Australians felt about Trump as the nominee. 77% would have preferred Hillary Clinton as president. Only 11% would have preferred President Trump. In our own polling history, and we've polled on other presidential elections, that puts him actually second lowest, ahead of Mitt Romney. But in that case, there was a huge difference between President Obama and President and candidate Romney in that particular election contest for Australians anyway. This is going to have huge ramifications for the way Australians feel about the US alliance and about the US generally, and we know from our history of polling that Australians actually respond quite strongly to changes of presidents and cycles of US politics. And we expect that given the low readings on President Trump's popularity in Australia that we have so far, and that might change, is that we would expect Australians to feel a little bit less warmly to the United States and also to feel a little bit less strongly about how important the alliance is. But as far as advice to the government, I agree with everything that James has said in terms of taking it on an issue-by-issue basis. We're only less than two weeks out from an inauguration, so it is a little bit early, I think, to be putting a clear line in the sand. But what this does for me is shines a very clear spotlight on the foreign policy white paper process, which is something we haven't talked about yet. And I think generally this was expected to be a bit of a not particularly a big event document and wasn't expected to have a huge amount of resources put in behind it, whatever the white paper might say. But I think it now is more important than ever for Australia to define what its foreign policy interests and values are, dealing with an America which is very unfamiliar to it, more isolationist, more protectionist, more nationalist, lots of ists there, but that seems to be the America we're going to be dealing with at least for the next 4 years. And so I think it's crucial that that the work that goes into the white paper, which is due in the middle of this year, really focuses on what Australians' interests and values are, and particularly with relation to how we define our relationship and how it's poised between our trading interests in Asia and particularly with China and our alliance interests with the United States.
Finally, Aaron, how do you think the Australian government or governments around the world should balance these competing interests with Mr. Trump?
I think there's two questions. Beyond the question of, you know, do you do a Trudeau or do you do a Theresa May, the question is, if you do a Theresa May, if you try and take the approach that Britain has taken and try to influence the Trump administration, in what do you do that in service of? Are you doing it merely in service of narrow national interests that you believe you are likely to be able to protect? You might put the refugee deal into this category Prime Minister Turnbull did with President Obama. Or are you doing it in service of a broader liberal international order upon which countries like Australia, really all countries, rely? And I think this is going to be a very difficult question for the government. It's probably going to be easier to defend, you know, very narrow priorities, getting Australian dual citizens into the United States, not wrapped up in this immigration executive order, because the Trump administration seems, at least at this point, to be so hostile to the liberal international order. I know, Michael, you called your Boyer lectures last year, you know, present at the destruction, and that seems to have been an understatement. It was a reference to Dean Acheson's present at the creation, which was the title of his autobiography about establishing the liberal international order. So what role can a country like Australia, which has the advantage of being an Anglosphere country, Trump seems to like the Anglosphere, he seems to see things in those terms, what role can Australia play by using that heritage to try and influence the Trump administration to move toward more of a liberal view of the world? And I think that'll be a very difficult question for the government.
And the related question is, how do you influence Donald Trump? What are the points of influence? It goes back in a way to the question that I stated at the beginning, will he be a chairman, in which case secretaries and other officials are the obvious points of influence and leverage. But if he's more of an activist, if he really is an activist, then on these big questions, he will hug these issues to himself. And I don't think anybody has really cracked the question of the best way to change Donald Trump's mind. You and I were talking earlier, Aaron, about how he's receptive to General Mattis on the question of torture, but on many other questions, so far he's impervious to external attempts to influence him. So this is one issue that minds in Canberra will be turning over. Once we've decided what we want to do and how we'd like to influence them, how do we actually go about doing it?
And I would just add to that is the question of through whom do you do it? And so, of course, Prime Minister Turnbull was second off the rank to be able to give President Trump a call, but he got Trump's cell phone number through Greg Norman. And I spoke to a Southeast Asian government official when we were in Washington who told me that he felt very comfortable in the new Washington because it reminded him so much of Jakarta, that prominent businessmen show him photos that they've taken with Trump on the golf course and say, see, you know, President Trump and I are very close. And that's how money and that's how power flows. And if that is indeed the new Washington, then all the work that an organization like DFAT puts into getting to know the next rank of Republican foreign policy professionals, that may not have been worth very much in the Trump administration.
Right. So Mr. Turnbull should be working on his golf game. All right. Who would like to kick off the questions? Yes, I'm going to ask people to wait till the microphone comes and then state your affiliation before asking
Robert Milliken,
a question.
I'm a journalist. I write for The Economist magazine. James, I'd just like to follow up on your assessment of where Australia stands. Your excellent book that Michael mentioned at the beginning, you point out that the bipartisanship on the US alliance has never been thinner. There's never been less space between it. And yet you say that in the terms of Australia's own national interests, Australian government should be prepared more to stand up and to fight with America. How capable do you think that an Australian government faced with all the uncertainties of a Trump administration in the region might be of doing that, particularly in view of Alex's polling showing that Australia's warmth towards the United States plummets under an unpopular president?
So how capable are they of standing up to America and taking a divergent path? Yeah. Well, as I said, I mean, so far the government's response to Trump has taken two forms. One is there was an attack on the Labor Party who came out late last year under Penny Wong, their foreign affairs spokesperson, who signalled an attempted sort of re-examination of the alliance, but within the framework of it. I mean, this was no kind of argument for leaving it. Now Turnbull hopped all over Wong and said that this was a threat to Australian security, which in many ways was reminiscent of the kind of Cold War political debate in this country about the alliance, which Labor was depicted as weak. The second kind of response has been, as I mentioned before, I guess what that former British ambassador to Washington, Sir Christopher Meyer, called the oleaginous language of the relationship that stresses shared values and shared history. I suspect on things, for example, like, you know, we know that Trump will demand more of allies. What we don't know is what form that will take for Australia. Now, if, for example, it takes the form of further requests for freedom of navigation patrols through the disputed zone around those islands, then I suspect the Turnbull government will not change its position.
Australians would like it, though.
To do freedom of navigation patrols.
Mm, very strongly in favour.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's a case to be made for doing them, but doing them in concert with what we've been doing since the 1980s under Operation Gateway. But actually following the United States through that disputed zone, I'm not sure that serves our national interest. And the Labor Party have been more hawkish on this than the government, intriguingly, more hairy-chested on it. But I suspect the Turnbull government wouldn't change its position. And I think the government, what this refugee deal shows too, and the way they've been able to extract the concession, is clearly they're not of the view that they don't want to scream at the administration. I think they know that will achieve nothing. So they will work quietly behind the scenes to extract concessions where they feel there has been a policy or an executive order that runs counter to our national interest. And that's probably what we're going to see more of. But I think they are capable of it. But I don't think they're going to do it in a kind of a tub-thumping, kind of aggressive, posturing nationalist kind of way. They won't be doing it to sort of stand up for Australian independence. I think they'll be doing it where they feel that the United States is pushing Australia in a direction that we don't really want to go, where we feel that that's going to rub up uneasily against what we want to maximise from our relationship with the Chinese. Then I think we're going to be a lot more prepared to say no to Washington.
Alex, let me give you an opportunity to remind us of the opinion poll results on the freedom of navigation patrols, but let me also ask you a follow-up question. We've been talking about the opportunities and I guess the risks for the government. What are the risks and opportunities for the opposition in this whole debate? Because they're opening up some distance between themselves and the government on the alliance. They've Senator Wong said last year that the election of Mr. Trump was a change point. Mr. Shorten has, I guess, taken more of the Trudeau approach to Mr. Trump's actions. Is there more opportunity here because of the unpopularity of Mr. Trump, or is there Is there also a risk that sort of unstated under the opinion in the opinion polling is that there's still a very strong majority of Australians who want a government that can manage the relationship with the United States?
Yes, there is. Sorry to have interrupted you before
No problem.
To go back to the first question, yes, there was very strong support for conducting freedom of navigation operations, which was a very surprising response to what we thought was a pretty tricky question, actually. But three quarters, which is a strong result for us in our polling, so it's a strong an indication that it was pretty on pretty firm ground. Of Australians thought that they that Australia should conduct freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. So the opposition may have well have had that result in mind when they took that stance late last year in being more bullish and hairy-chested on the South China Sea issue. On the question of the of taking a this, I guess, what the public opinion that we have, then what we know about public opinion on the US alliance would give the opposition a bit more confidence in taking a stronger stance on some of these issues. But on the overall attitudes towards the alliance, and Robert, you mentioned that feelings sort of plummet in relation to the US alliance with changes of president. They do fall sharply, but they're still strongly positive. So the overarching the overarching context is that Australians are broadly supportive of our alliance relationship with the United States. So it doesn't fall so far as to say the majority of Australians would oppose us continuing an alliance with the United States with an unpopular president. And George W. Bush was as unpopular as President Trump is in the Australian context. So that's what I would say is that the Labor Party would need to be a little bit careful if it was taking an eye on the popular opinion about how it framed such disagreement with the United States.
All right, let me. The next hand I saw was a gentleman over here on the corner, and please, other people, catch my eye if you'd like me to go to you for a question.
Yeah, John Connor, I have no relevant affiliation. Really, just I'd like the panel's thoughts on a couple of observations. The first is that. But in looking at the Trump administration and the pattern of the US government, at this time, shouldn't we also be focusing on the impact of a variety of, the, of Trump policies on various parts of the country, which will have an immediate or very rapid impact on Republican members of Congress? For instance, if we look at what is almost an undeclared war, economic war in Mexico, that has a huge impact on all the border states, and especially Texas and California. And personally, I'd be very surprised if that doesn't begin to reflect itself quite quickly in the attitudes of Republican members of Congress from those states. Similarly, throughout the U.S., there is one enormous constituency that actually has great influence, and that's the legal profession, and not just in the courts. And one of the things that's almost bred into every U.S. lawyer is a reverence for the 14th Amendment and due process. And the fact is that this administration is going out of its way to charge headlong against any concept of due process in almost everything it does. And whether that's recognized or not, the impact of that in, on most American lawyers will be most negative.
Okay,
and they are highly influential both in Democrats and Republicans. So, in other words, I think the reaction, you've got to look at segments of the U.S. society and not simply a constitutional limitation.
Thank you. I'm going to take that. I'm going to ask Aaron to address that. How will it affect the, those particular segments, those geographical segments, and also the lawyers of the United States?
I think it's a useful point to make that, you know, I think a lot of people are asking who America is right now. And when you look at the scenes over the weekend, you see the number of lawyers who were driving to international airport terminals all across the country. To offer pro bono services to immigrants and green card holders, permanent residents who were trapped at airports because of the executive order. You saw thousands of people pouring into those terminals to protest the executive order. There is a lot of opposition to a lot of the things that, that President Trump is doing. And I hope people, as we focus so much, Donald Trump sucks up so much oxygen in any room that he's in and in our discussion. But it's important to keep in mind that he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. He didn't have much of a turnout at his inauguration, and there is this level of opposition in the United States. But I don't yet see that level of opposition in the House of Representatives. And so there are no major Republican voices in the House of Representatives who have come out against the executive order. There are in the Senate, But, you know, going back to this question about 4 years or less, the House is the body that has to impeach the president before it can get to the Senate. And so I just think that, you know, while perhaps that will have an impact on President Trump's popularity down the line, it's not something that's likely to have an impact on his ability to remain in power in the near to medium term.
All right. I saw this gentleman next in the first row, Tara.
Thank you. Malcolm Carson, Chairman, Dampier Gold. I guess my question is, was the rise of Trump inevitable? We use the analogy with the Australian political environment where our political parties have been in disarray in the last few elections. They don't seem to be capable of winning the centre where they need to be, and we're split down the middle. Should we not be taking a lesson from the US? Should politicians not be taking a lesson? Should we not be looking forward and saying, okay, this is an outcome. This is an outcome of a democracy. We get what we deserve. What are the implications of us of this administration economically? We can all express a lot of unhappiness if that's our feelings towards Trump's election, but we are a democracy. It is what it is. So should our focus be politicians need to get their act together rather rapidly and look very hard at themselves, and we in the economic environment need to be thinking hard about what those ramifications might be. Mm. So my question is, was it inevitable, as was Brexit?
Very good question. Let me have 30 seconds on it and then go to whomever on the panel would like to have a crack at it. The closer you get to the political process, my own view is the less inevitable any outcome seems. And we all know, as Aaron says, that Secretary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million, and that if her election campaign had managed to get 100,000 votes more in three seats that they lost and 100,000 votes less in three seats that they won, then she would be the president of the United States now, and we'd be having a completely different discussion. The discussion would be about all that talk of populism was wrong. In fact, the insiders still know how to deliver these things, and there's a very well-known group of people around the president whom we're going to be liaising with. So I agree with the premise of your question, which is that there are definitely subterranean forces, and I think we need to take them seriously. But I'm also conscious that if a few political professionals in Brooklyn had made different decisions in the last month of the election campaign, we may well be having a completely different panel. But that's my take on it. Who'd like to have a crack at it?
Oh, quickly.
James?
Yes. I mean, one argument is that a Trump-like figure could have emerged a lot earlier. Why did it take that long in the American political system, given, as you know, decades of wage inequality, fatigue with a dysfunctional Congress, and a kind of a tiredness with American blood and treasure being expended abroad. Now, what are the implications here? And Trump was able to harness these subterranean forces better than anybody. Now, we have had, of course, an experience of this kind of a fairly ugly kind of populism in the late 1990s under Pauline Hanson, which was a reaction against those who did feel that rapid economic and social change in the 80s and 90s had left them disenfranchised, had left them feeling as if they weren't part of the majority anymore, had left them feeling that the essence of Australia had been lost. And that was kind of bundled out of the political system. It wasn't a rapid economic downturn at the time. If there was a rapid economic downturn in Australia, then I think the potential is probably there. But I also take your point. I mean, I am still waiting for the political leaders to articulate more of a case about what are the big questions facing the country, what are the challenges. I mean, it doesn't all have to be sort of, no one's saying you have to have a very neat narrative. I mean, that might not be the circumstances. Today's media circumstances may not necessarily be conducive to that, but there is certainly still a case for political leaders to make more of an intellectual case, I think, for where the country is headed and what it needs to do to navigate these kinds of uncharted, unsettled waters. And we haven't had it. We thought we were going to get it at the beginning of the Turnbull administration, but in many ways I think I can't remember a speech that has been given in recent years that would say, here is a headland speech
that sets up the big questions facing this country. Alex, do you want to weigh in on just on this question about the some of these subterranean forces and to what extent they have purchase in the Australian debate?
Well, the first point is don't underestimate the impact of our compulsory voting. A lot of what happened in Brexit and in the US election was a polarisation along age and demographic lines, and particularly age. A lot of the younger voters didn't turn out to vote, a very low proportion this year, sorry, in 2016 in comparison with previous years. And the same happened with the Brexit vote, a very low proportion of those 18 to 29-year-olds or the Gen Ys or whatever, millennials or whatever you want to call them, actually turned out to vote. And they were the ones who were strongly pro-Remain, and they were also the ones who were the strongest Hillary Clinton supporters. So that was a factor, and we don't have that here. We do have a slight demographic issue with our even within our compulsory voting framework, which is that we find it hard to get 18 and 19-year-olds to actually register to vote. And there were several hundred thousand 18 to 24-year-olds, I think, in Australia in the last election who were not. We don't have the data yet because we're quite slow at producing that sort of data, but that, who didn't actually enrol to vote. So there is a little bit of an issue with youth turnout, and that can have a difference. And they are the group who actually feel the strongest about democracy having failed us, as I interpret the results of our quite simple question, which has been asked around the world by the Pew Polling Organisation about what is the most preferable form of government. And around 60% of Australians, only 60%, say that democracy is the most preferable form of government, which was quite a surprising result, but quite consistent with a lot of other questions, similar questions about trust in institutions and parliaments and the political process that have been asked in Western democracies around the world. So we shouldn't have been surprised, but we were nonetheless surprised. And within that 60%, it's the 18 to 29-year-old demographic group who are seem to be the least committed to democracy as the preferable form of government. And the reasons behind this, as we discovered a couple of years ago when we recruited a large sample of that age group to try and find out what was driving this apparent disenchantment, was the sense that the political parties weren't representing their interests, they were representing only the interests of a few, and that there was actually no difference between no difference between the major political parties at all. So to James's point about an opportunity to articulate a different policy of one party or the other and actually be a bit more strident with political conviction might actually satisfy some of those young voters who feel disenfranchised and disillusioned with the way the political system is working.
Now, we've only got about 5 more minutes. I might take a couple of questions and then give everybody an opportunity to address those questions just in a minute or so. I know now all the hands come up. I saw this lady here. I'll go to you first.
Thank you, Carol Austin. Can I get the panel to talk about Trump the man? He first floated the idea of standing for president some time ago. It wasn't that he was motivated by a desire to change America. He'd been a reality TV star, and the next thing you do is become president of the United States if you want to inflate your ego. So he's clearly a self-absorbed narcissist, which is why he's so prickly, he's got such a thin skin. So now he's starting to talk about the 8 years in power. The sorts of things he's doing now is executive orders. He's ticking off the list. I told you I'd do this. I'm doing it. He's setting his track record so that when he stands for power in 4 years' time, he can say he did what he promised, and anything that doesn't happen will be because he's blocked by others. My question is the lens that we should be using to look at Trump is an extraordinary egotist, a narcissist that is driven by the desire to be the most powerful man in the world, rather than the lens we typically use for politicians.
Okay, thank you. And I'll take as the last question the gentleman here who's had his hand up for a while. Just a quick question, if I can ask you to put that, and then I want to give everybody a minute or so to answer a couple of questions.
Tony Dowling, College of Radiologists affiliation. Donald Trump has said one of the things he's keen on is going after ISIL. Do you think that means he's going to put troops on the ground in Syria? And does that also mean that they will ask Australia to send troops and we will automatically send troops as we always do?
All right, thank you. So two very different questions, and maybe I'll start with you again, James. The first is, what is the lens? What's the right analytical lens for Mr. Trump? He wouldn't be the first person to run for president wanting to be the most powerful person in the world, I'd suggest. But is there something different about him that means that we should analyse him differently from other presidents? And what do we think about his policy on ISIL, his policy on the use of force and what it means for us? And you've each got about 90 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, he's not the first. I mean, presidents are generally not shrinking violets. But I take your point that there is something distinctive. I think it was the international relations expert John Mearsheimer in Chicago who said that Trump is quite ignorant about the outside world and he shoots from the hip, and that is a lethal combination. But the question is too, I mean, to what extent will he learn that politics is also about compromise and about sometimes having losses? Everything's about the deal, it's about transactions, it's about winning. I mean, you look at the language he used, he said America is not winning anymore. We're being done over in trade. We're being done over by our allies. So how does he, or does he ever, contemplate that politics is about having to endure losses or suffer losses? That's a big question. Now, as for the question of more troops, I mean, there is no doubt, I think, that Trump is reaching out to Putin with the potential offer of trying to turn around American policy in Syria. That may or may not involve more troops, and it may or may not involve a request to Australia. I noticed that one of the more hawkish commentators in the Australian debate has already suggested that Australian leaders go to Washington with a kind of a basket of strategic goodies, one of them being that we offer a battalion for the Middle East. And, you know, my argument would be this is not in Australia's core interests. So if we're going to do what we've been talking about here today, and that is help to try and shape and influence this administration, then the emphasis has got to be on this part of the world. But if you read Julie Bishop's speech in LA, a lot of that was about reminding the Trump administration of all the help and assistance in terms of boots on the ground that the Australians had been giving the administration in the Middle East.
Alex.
Oh, just very quickly on the boots on the ground scenario. Australians were quite pro our engagement in Syria and Iraq as long as it was confined to air support and military assistance and training, according to our own polling. But they were quite weary of our engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan and never particularly enamoured of them. And crucially, around 60% of Australians said they would be less likely to support Australia taking military action under a President Trump when we asked them this question in the middle of last year. So I suspect we'd be on very thin ground indeed if we were talking about increasing our commitments in those theatres under this particular president.
Aaron.
I think my colleagues have addressed those two questions comprehensively, but I just wanted to say, we just learned that as we've been sitting here, this feels a little bit like election night, Michael, where the updates kept rolling in. We learned that President Trump has fired the acting attorney general who had ordered her Justice Department attorneys not to defend the immigration executive order. This is unexpected, frankly, but she is the only Senate-confirmed official that was still at the Justice Department. She was an Obama appointee, a career prosecutor, who was appointed by Obama to be Deputy Attorney General, and she understood that she would be enforcing the orders of the new administration. But the Attorney General, and this is regularly an issue in our system, has an obligation to defend the Constitution, as opposed to, she's not the President's lawyer, she's the Constitution's lawyer. And so her decision to do that, I think, will go down with the decision of Richard Nixon's Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General, who refused to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor who was prosecuting Watergate. I think it was a particularly courageous stand, but this is also how our system works. President Trump is well within his rights to fire the acting Attorney General when this happens. So this goes to the question of, will institutions mold the president, or will the president begin to change those institutions? You know, in this case, it seems that the White House, that the president has won, and the institutions perhaps have not.
You see, again, you hear the breaking news at the Lowy Institute. So I want to thank Mr. Trump for timing that intervention so perfectly. I would just make one comment in relation to the lady's question, and that is that Mr. Trump's personality is definitely unusual. Very unusual. There have been very unusual personalities in that office before. Richard Nixon was one of them. Bill Clinton himself was not like Mr. Trump, but he was another unusual personality. It's definitely something to pay attention to. Myself, I'm more concerned, actually, not that his personality is so different, but that views he's held over a long period of time put him outside of the mainstream of US thinking. We have never had an unbeliever in the global liberal order sitting in the Oval Office since the Second World War. We've never had a president who doesn't believe that allies are good for the United States and good for the world. We've never had a president who flat out is hostile to free trade. And we haven't had a president for a long time who is apparently has an instinctive attraction to strong men like Vladimir Putin, who are hostile, declared opponents of the global order that Australia is, of which Australia is a stakeholder. So although his personality is what it is, and it's very diverting to watch him, to me it's actually a few long-held views he has about America's role in the world that that are more troubling. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you all for joining us. This is the first installment in a long conversation that the Lowy Institute will preside over. It will feature expert commentary, events like this, visitors from the United States, long-form research. We will mobilise all of our intellectual resources to try to address the this important task of examining Mr. Trump. The last piece of information I'll give you was the funny line that I had to laugh at when I was in Washington. I was speaking to a Republican insider who himself was considering whether to go into the administration, and he was just regaling to me how many of his colleagues, his other conservative Republicans, had decided not to go into the administration or had been ruled out of going into the administration by Mr. Trump because they'd opposed him during the campaign. And he looked at me with a smile and said, "Michael, the Donald Trump administration is not as good as it looks." So that's what we'll be doing at the Lowy Institute, working out whether it's as good as it looks, and also how we as a country can make it better. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for coming. And let me just tell you that next Monday at 12:45 here at Bligh Street, we will have our customary first event of the year, that is to look at the year ahead in international affairs from around the world. And I'll be joined by Dr. Ewan Graham, director of our security program, Dr. Meriden Varal, our director of our East Asia program, and Dr. John Edwards, a non-resident fellow here in economics. So we hope to see many of you here next Monday. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.